We are starting the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and story, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media. We'll start the show with my homage to Shakespeare, which is a preparation for my interview of the cast of King Lear. King Lear is going to be playing at the Wallace through June 5th. Then I play some Elizabethan music, music from Shakespeare's time. Then an interview with Ron Saucy, who is the director of the Odyssey Theater. You can see his compelling production of Wakings at the Odyssey Theater through June 5th. And we round out the show with a performance by Ukrainian-American pianist Ina Felix, performing Beethoven's Bagatelles No. 3, 4, and 5, which she will also be performing on June 22, 2022, at the Wallace. The show is called Reimagine Beethoven and Ravel. You can find out more information about the King Lear run and Ina Felix on June 22nd at thewallace.org. Stay tuned. You may be a Shakespeare lover, or have been wanting to find out more about the Bard. Here's a little introduction that will hopefully pique your interest. Shakespeare is the most quoted English writer. He's the source of the most English quotes after the English Bible, which were both written around the same time. Here's some of my favorite Shakespeare quotes. We'll start with quotes from Hamlet, and one of the most famous ones of all. To be or not to be? That is the question. In case you're not clear on the meaning, Hamlet is contemplating suicide. Suicide. To be or not to be? Here's more from Hamlet. The lady doth protest too much, methinks. To thine own self be true. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Neither a borrower nor lender be, for loan oft loses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This from As You Like It. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. From Romeo and Juliet. What's in a name? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. And from Henry IV, Part 1, the better part of valor is discretion. From Henry IV, Part 2, uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. From Richard III, now is the winter of our discontent. A horse, my kingdom for a horse. From Sonnet 18, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. From The Merchant of Venice, all that glistens is not gold. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, Shall we not revenge? From Othello. I am one who loved not wisely, but too well. From The Tempest. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows. And from A Midsummer Night's Dream, love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind, and therefore is winged Cupid painted blind. The course of true love never did run smooth. Lord, what fools these mortals be! And from Julius Caesar, the fault, dear Brutus, lies not within the stars, but within ourselves. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. Cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once. Much ado about nothing. Some Cupid kills with arrows, some with traps. These three are from King Lear. I am a man more sinned against than sinning. Nothing will come of nothing. How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. And these last two from Twelfth Night. If music be the food of love, play on. And finally, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. I actually wrote a play based on the Twelfth Night, but about cheese. I'd like to read you a quote from it. It's about Parmesan cheese. Some come grated, some you grate, and some have a greater thrust upon them. A while back, I decided that I would see every one of Shakespeare's plays before I die. Almost there. I mean, seeing all his plays, not being dead. Let me give you some movie version recommendations to get you started. Feel free to contact me and I'll email you these details. Yeah, watch every wonderful film that I mention, and you will either be excited about Shakespeare all over again, or you'll be newly in love with his work. Shakespeare has comedic, tragic, and historical plays. If you'd like to dig into some serious Shakespeare, The Hollow Crown is a TV miniseries, which are beautifully directed and acted adaptations of the Bard's history plays. Romeo and Juliet, there's a lovely classic version by Franco Zeffirelli. And Baz Luhrmann has a great modern adaptation from 1996 with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. Hamlet. For Hamlet, there's a solid Franco Zeffirelli version from 1990 with Mel Gibson and Glenn Close. The Tragedy of Macbeth? Well, there's a fine version just out directed by Joel Coen, starring Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand, and also a moving version starring Michael Fassbender, released in 2015. Tempest? In 2010, Julie Taymor came out with a wonderful version. A Midsummer Night's Dream. There's a 1999 version directed by Michael Hoffman. The ensemble features Kevin Kline, Michelle Pfeiffer, Rupert Everett, Stanley Tucci, Calista Flockhart, and Christian Bale. That was fun. And King Lear. Check out Akira Kurosawa's 1985 Ran, R-A-N. It's based on King Lear. Devastatingly good. Or better yet, there's a compelling adaptation of King Lear at the Wallace in Beverly Hills through June 5th. More information at thewallace.org. Here's my interview with some of the cast.
April 26th, 2022. I'm at the Wallace with some of the cast from a production that's starting called King Lear.
My name is Emily Swallow, and I'm playing Goneril.
My name is River Gaia, and I'm playing Cordelia and the Fool.
And my name is Bree Ely. I'm playing Regan.
How exciting. And this is an unusual production. It's dealing with some pretty intense environmental issues.
Even more than the environment, it's just the idea of how the script has been pared down to really look at the different members of these families. For anyone who knows Lear, you set it up with a kingdom being divided by these three daughters and their husbands, but in our production, we have no husbands. And we've also cut out a lot of the other ancillary characters, equally important, but for the sake of this theme of how these families are interacting, they're not here.
But we have done that without readapting any of the text, really. There's minor tweaks here and there, but it really is mostly Shakespeare's original text. Some of the lines that did belong to characters who have been cut, like Kent, Cornwall, Albany, Oswald, they have been reassigned to other characters when they need to be said for purposes of the plot. And that's really interesting because it does sometimes change the motivation of those lines, yeah, and the intention. But it's still really the original text, so it's not like we've done a major overhaul or rewrite or anything. It's just a bit shorter, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. And to your point, it's set in the future, 40 years into the future, and kind of imagining what the climate crisis, what gender identity, those conversations that are hot right now and so important and vital right now, what they would be like 40 years from now in the United States. In the original play, there's a storm that's happening outside. In our version, there is an environmental storm, but it's also about the technological storm and the psychological and psychic space of what it means to be flooded with information via social media and technology, and how that affects all of our, the way we interact with each other, what that means to the dynamics of power and image that we have
of each other
and our characters and our family, because we are royal, but we're also like live on Instagram. So
there's something though about this idea, like how the power is shifting because we don't have husbands. Usually the Regan character and Goneril are married. When you remove that and it is just about how you own the power or how you fight for the power, I think it makes it really exciting to play. And then you also get the extra bonus of how you are seen as powerful from your people in social media, and how you're seen as powerful in the media that writes about you because you are a royal member of the families. It's been a delicious kind of little thing to live in.
This is very contemporary production, very current, and that leads me to, well, my first question. Generally, you have Shakespeare lovers, but then other people who are a little scared of it or think it's antique or stuffy, or the language sometimes is hard for people to access. What about this show will open people to Shakespeare in general?
Well, I think if Shakespeare is well acted, you should be able to understand it. So I'm certainly not going to call anybody out, but I feel like if you haven't been able to understand a production, it probably wasn't acted well, no matter where it was set.
Like LA people putting on thick English accents that don't match well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't need to do that. I think that it does come down to just really understanding what you're saying. And I think that everyone in our cast understands what they're saying, and that sounds so simple. But I also think the themes that Shakespeare writes about are universal and they're timeless. And so I think that that's why it is easy to put this play in the future and for it to feel like it's completely contemporary and relatable, and to be completely emotionally invested in it. And I think that we are in more contemporary dress, so I think that makes it feel a little more relatable.
Yeah.
And I think seeing it's a really diverse cast, so I think that makes it feel more relatable. But then at the foundation of it, I think it's just that we're invested in what we're saying, and hopefully we will communicate that clearly.
There was an early conversation that we had as a cast about like what this play is about. And I, for most of my life, I've been one of those people that I didn't understand Shakespeare. I went to acting school and I loved performing and acting Shakespeare monologues and stuff. But like when it came to seeing a show, I'd be like, I have no idea what the hell's going on right now.
It's opaque.
It's dense. But to Emily's point, you know, when it's well acted, but I think really what's really special about this production is, we were talking about this as a cast, is what it's really about is what happens when you have a group of people who have a bedrock, a foundation that they think their lives are made on top of, but there's a sudden shift and then suddenly everyone's scrambling for power, looking out for themselves, and it becomes just a mad rush into your own self-interest, and subsequently the descent into madness, and what that, how that looks like differently for different people. And as we were performing this play, in my own personal life, I started seeing those things about how when there's like a little piece of something, and how people just want to, I mean, especially in this town, just like, you know, like
go out for themselves.
Themselves. And what it means to, I mean, it's a cautionary tale because there are different, we don't have to all die in the end, spoiler alert, but
it's a tragedy.
Yeah, but like what happens when, you know, you completely lose track of love and compassion for each other and family and community, which is what family should be based around, but like suddenly everything becomes about, you know, yourself and what and looking out for your own future, and just the chaos that ensues from that kind of
self-preservation.
Exactly.
There's also a hope that I'm willing into the audience as they leave, that they'll think about, instead of turning left, what if we turned right? What if we did extend that olive branch? What if we did make that call and said, I forgive you? What if I did say, it's okay, I know you got angry and it wasn't just because of this, it was you in that moment. Like, how might we not, you know, fall down the hill towards a tragedy in our lives, and could we actually be climbing back up the hill together instead of it being a, you know, crabs in a barrel situation? Because I love that there are multiple moments in this play where we can see how the character could have made a choice to embrace that love and empathy, and then they were like, nah.
Yeah, there's multiple instances of what we kind of see like in our culture today, this tendency to, like, as soon as somebody makes a mistake, to just immediately cut them off with no hope of reconciliation. And that happens in this play a lot. And you see, I mean, that's where some of the storm that you were talking about, like, that's where you kind of see that played out in an emotional way. And you see the damage that just keeps, it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And
it talks to a reactionary culture, which is what we're living in now.
Absolutely.
But like, what happens when we ourselves as people are just hot to just completely follow our impulses and not just be like, wait, let's just think about this for a second. Can we breathe? Yeah. Can we talk nicely? But yeah, so it's really fascinating how this is written.
1606-ish?
Yeah, 500 years
ago. Somewhere in the 60s.
It's 400 years ago. And somehow it still is able to transcend present day reality in a way
people
that's...
People are still people.
Yeah.
So for the person who maybe thinks that they are going to be afraid of hearing this language, I ask, have you ever loved someone? Have you ever hated someone? Have you wanted to push them down the stairs? Come see Lear. You know, there you will find a current that it will hit in you, because it's about how we live in our world. no matter what time or when that world is.
I think this is something that theater does. It takes people into these dark chambers, into these difficult places, and particularly in this show, it presents options. And so this deals with environmental catastrophe, but there's some rays of light coming in too, and it's giving people choices.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like that's the whole point of this, one of the important points of this production.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we're dealing with, everyone's dealing with storms all the time. How you choose to, you know, move through them, respond, is how we show who we, like our character, you know, and whether it's emotionally or, and, you know, we have this emotional and there's political storms happening and there's environmental storms. In the same way that you can have those kinds of battles in yourself, like, how you move through them is how we keep a society going.
Yeah.
And we have to move through them. They keep coming at us. So it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
And you get to see the characters, you know, different characters do so with different levels of success and some with wit and humor and some with some pretty crabby behavior and... So you get to see that there's options.
In theater, we go into this dark room, and the actors and directors take us into these chambers of self. And we can explore these things like devotion to family, love, betrayal, cruelty, all themes in King Lear. It helps us process, because we're living with this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Through the arts, it perhaps helps it move.
I think so. I mean, I think that the power of storytelling is that it allows us to have a distance from ourselves that lets us learn more readily. Because I think, I mean, you know, that's why we have fables for kids and why we tell stories, because there's, when someone is looking at you directly and saying, you need to learn this or you need to know this, there's a part of our brains, I think, that kind of like gets defensive or tunes out. But when you're looking at something through a story, you can pick up lessons differently. That's why we teach kids that way. And I know for me personally, every time I work on a character, there's something that I will discover in service of the character that will make me look at that aspect of my own life differently. And I'll say, oh, that's something that I guess I'd need to pay attention to in my own life. And I would never have discovered that if I weren't doing it in the service of this story and in looking at this other, you know, seemingly this other person that's actually me, that's actually not me, that's, you know, all of the weird psychology of that. But yeah, I mean, hopefully it's a catharsis and we go into the dark together and we experience this story and then we get to come out changed.
A little lighter, maybe.
Yeah.
Could you each relate a personal story or how theater has changed you or how this show has changed you? I mean, you're all professional actors. This is how you make your living. But it also has, I think, a deep psychic effect on you, psychological effect, that you get transformed while you are transforming other people, either in general or specifically for this production.
I think for this production, for me, I learned so much from playing Cordelia. She is, you know, a beacon of light and truth, and to a fault, you know, she's the reason for all the chaos that ensues. She cannot not tell the truth. She was just born to say her piece, to express her honesty, even if it comes out clumsily or if it comes out not at the right time, which clearly this is not the right time to tell her father that, you know, she couldn't shower him with compliments as he wanted to, his daughters to. And for me, it, you know, I identify as non-binary and trans. For me, it was so radical to inhabit a character that owns her space so much, because so much often in my life, I, you know, try to adapt or make myself small or, you know, don't correct someone with my pronouns because I'm like, okay, I'll just let it slide. But inhabiting Cordelia, I was just like, no, I it behooves not only me, but it's in service of the highest good for all people if I can express my truth and my honesty and my reality at all moments, however it comes out, when it comes out. And it's just been such a gift to inhabit a character that is just such a badass. And even though it does at the end, but she, you know, I think her, and it's the beauty of also John, the director's vision of why he wanted Cordelia to be trans, for someone who has walked the walk in her truth and has had to deal with coming forth and announcing to the world everywhere she moves who she is. So for me, it's just been just so humbling to, and honestly a benefit to my life to walk in her shoes.
So by embodying the archetypes that Cordelia represent,
yeah,
for the audience,
yeah,
a kind of a shamanic journey for the audience, you are also changed by embodying all this energy and friction.
Oh yeah, I've had many tough conversations in the last month and doing this production that I was like, wow, I wonder if I would have said the things that I said or had the confidence or courage to say them had I not been in this production.
Thank you, River. Emily?
Oh my gosh, yes. I feel like being an actor, it's sort of funny. I sort of feel like I stumbled into a profession that has saved my life. I feel like God made me want to be an actor so that I would actually feel more deeply and use emotions in a healthy way, because I, in my life, am so, I'm very, I like to process through things. I like to be very useful, and I like to find solutions, and I like to fix things. And I realize I often skip over how things make me feel. And so here I am as an actor where feeling emotions is absolutely vital and very useful in a way. And when I was in grad school, one of the first things they said to me was, you are trying too hard to figure out what we want. You're trying too hard to solve the problem, and you need to be more willing just to fall on your face and fail. And of course, I immediately was like, well, what does that mean? How do I do that? You know? And they said, if you continue this way, you are going to A, be really boring as an actor, and B, you are going to bore yourself as an actor. And I realized when they told me that, that not only was that true of my work as an actor, but that was going to be true of my life, you know, that I was like constantly like weighing all the options and trying to find like the quote unquote right choice for everything. And that's no way to live, because there is no like right choice. There's no right way to do anything. And so it's such a huge gift to get to, I mean, in this show, I get to play this character who, I mean, she, you know, she makes some big mistakes, but she tries so hard in her way to get through to the people in her family. She does it imperfectly, and to get have permission to try to that extent. And to know, you know, Emily knows that Goneril is maybe not using the best methods, but to be given permission to go so far and to experience these emotions so deeply, and to know that in doing so, it's in service of this character and this story and these other people that I'm working with in this greater project, and that it's actually like doing something, I hope, you know, doing something good. It's not just for me to implode. It's such an enormous gift. It just blows my mind that we get to do this together. And it's such an incredible privilege to get to experience what this, I mean, the trust that this cast brings to this process, and what everyone has been willing to put out there, because it's a bizarre thing to just come into a room with, in this case, it's seven actors in a play like this, of this emotional scope. And a friend of mine said, as actors, you assume trust first and then you work on earning it. You just walk in and you, and that has been true in spades of this group, and the level of trust is incredible and the generosity is incredible. And it's so beautiful that we get to do this in service of, you know, eventually an audience and this story that I do absolutely believe is resonant and will help people. I want to hear Bree's answer, though.
Oh, you know what they said. I think, so Regan is the third, or she's in the middle between her eldest sister, Gonwell, and the youngest sister, Cordelia. It's been really fun for me to explore what that feeling is of not getting there first, but also not being there last, so that you have to always kind of be floating and on, like, attention. Be like, hey, oh, aha, or did I do that well? I appreciate that there's a level of uncontrolled flair, and I come from a family where my father was a Marine, my mom was a school teacher. We didn't slam the door. Will you stop it in this house? No, you know, like there's a definitely a lot of like procedure and regulation that you have to have. So I always wanted to be a part of theater because I knew I could act a fool there and get to do it on purpose. But I do feel like in the scope of like being an adult and being a person who weathered the last 3 years that we've all been in, there's a sense that you do have to still like keep it all together. And she doesn't. Does it in really spectacular ways. And it's been delightful to find the spaces where like, oh yeah, I'll try it there. Ooh, I just surprised myself. You know, and also saying that like, it's okay to tell people what your opinion of them is and to let them feel that full force of them pissing you off, them disappointing you, them hurting you. Because in that truthful exchange, maybe you will get to something better. Mm-hmm. I've had some really great conversations with my mom in between these like rehearsals and stuff. And it's been fun to just bring a little more honesty about, like, if something pisses me off, I'm letting it fully come in. If something is making me upset, I'm letting it fully come in. And I hope that continues to be a part of her, like, wash over me. Good thing, too, because we are so busy with rehearsals, I'm not having to see too many of my friends in person, so they're not getting afraid version of me. But, I like that there's just that space and permission, and there's generosity to fail, and there's room to say, if you go too far, oh, it's okay, we can just like bring it back in, but go further. We just had the note today, be more. Like, everywhere you go in this world, you're having to be like, okay, be less, be in front, be on time. Yeah. This is like, nope. Luxuriate in how bad you can be, how saucy you can be, how mean. If he says, kill him harder, you know? So, I wouldn't recommend it for someone who's got tendencies in that way, but I think it's really just exciting that, especially after the last couple of years, that we have this space and room to feel all of it and release it in a way and use these beautifully written consonants and vowels and sounds to get it out.
Beautiful answer. Well, I think as creative people, we're sensitive. We're like antennas. We're picking up all this energy. And maybe when we're young, we're a little odd, or sometimes we're popular, but a little different.
Yeah.
But I think we need to do our art. We need to get on stage. We need to feel all this stuff big, feel it for the audience. And therein, we just come to life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
King Lear at the Wallace.
Come see it.
Come on down.
It is May 10th, 2022. Mystic Pete here with Ron Saucy. Hi, Ron. You are the founder of the Odyssey Theater in West Los Angeles. It's been around since 1969. A beautiful community space with three theaters in it on Sepulveda near Olympic. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Yes, I'm that ancient guy.
You're doing some very cutting-edge productions.
Well, thanks.
Tell me a word about its backgrounds, and then we'll talk about the play that I just saw called Wakings, which I was very impressed by.
Oh, I'm sort of a renegade from the film TV industry. I came out to California years ago to study at UCLA film department and wanted to direct film, and in those years it was very difficult unless you had some sort of contacts within the industry, and of course it was pre-videotape, so it was very expensive to go out and shoot your own movie on film. And so I got a job in the industry, not as a director, but in various capacities, which didn't get me any closer to directing. So out of frustration, I started a theater so that I could direct. I could do what I wanted to do, and I didn't have the problem of a quote breaking in unquote to the industry. And so we began in the late 60s, and it was a very sort of a hippie venture. It was a group of people, and we did a lot of group work. We had a little CD storefront in Hollywood Boulevard, on near Vermont, and we were there for about 3 years, and then we moved to Santa Monica and Bundy, and we were there for 12 years, and now we're in our present location. But it's been an on-again, off-again ensemble of people. Sometimes we work with a tight group of people over a period of time, and at other times it's been more of an open casting kind of thing, sort of a hybrid. And we've tried to do things that you can't really see on the tube or in film, things that are uniquely theater, that tended to have us in the early years do a lot of European stuff. A lot of German theater, a lot of English theater, because in these countries they were not sort of under the curse of naturalism, where everything was, kitchen sink drama or naturalistically inclined. That's changed a lot now, of course, with contemporary playwrights, but that's sort of our background. We were sort of an international, adventurous, experimental theater company.
So I just saw Wakings. It'll be till June 5th. That's at the Odyssey Theater, odysseytheater.com. It was a very compelling production. A small cast, but for one or two people to get on stage for 20 or 30 minutes and move us, these were good performers. You have a great crew.
It's an unusual situation because they are five people that I've worked with before in various capacities, and some of them have worked with each other. So that was, in that respect, enjoyable.
Well, this production is called Wakings, and you delve into themes of sleep, being awake, dreams, delusions, enlightenment, loss, and revelation. What was the inspiration for this production?
Well, I think for most of my life I've been interested in altered states of consciousness and what can go on with the human mind and human awareness other than our normal sort of waking awareness. I mean, there's a lot of variety, of course, in our normal waking awareness as we go through emotional things and perceptual things. But then there are these strange, odd states that are maybe not studied as much as they should be. And they range from hypnosis, which I did for a number of years, I did experiments with for a number of years, to the psychedelic experience or the altered state caused by certain drugs, to delusions caused by everything from Alzheimer's to psychosis to precognition. There's a whole bevy of kind of states of mind that are not part of our normal diet, normal experience. And I've always been fascinated by them, and I decided I'd try to put together an evening that would, to some degree, explore some of them as much as one can do in one evening of theater. So we have four pieces, each of which explores a different aspect of awareness.
Well, are you into the spiritual stuff, too? Mystic
Peter? Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've been, you name it, I've been through it. Buddhism, Hinduism, Sufism, the Western mysticism, a lot of it through the years, through probably for over 50 years.
Well, you certainly take us on a journey through these four plays. They're all in very different directions and have different statements.
Well, it goes from a Pinter play, which is about a fantasy and delusion, a cab driver and his dispatcher, and the cab driver is having delusions. From there into an expansion of the Rip Van Winkle story, where Rip Van Winkle not only woke up after 20 years, but apparently he's still roaming around trying to figure out what happened to him. And when he describes his experiences, they sound very much like somebody describing an acid experience. And you know, where matter becomes vibrating particles, and where things morph into other things, and so on. And then the third piece is based loosely on the book Awakenings by Oliver Sacks. It's the same book that became the movie Awakenings with Robert De Niro and Robin Wilson. What happened is that Pinter was influenced by the book, but he didn't do it exactly. He kind of did his take on it. And it's about a woman who's been asleep for 29 years. And this was part of a whole epidemic that affected the world way back in the 20s and 30s. And not till they come up with a certain drug are they able to wake up these people after 29 years. And this is a woman who went to sleep at 16 and wakes up at 45 and isn't really sure of her condition. They try to convince her of her condition, but she can't put it all together. And she also talks about what happened while she was in this coma. And then the final piece is a short excerpt from Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, which is a search for spiritual enlightenment. And it concerns the final moments of Siddhartha's journey before his awakening, that we have transformed into a little theater piece, and is maybe the ultimate state of mind of the states portrayed in the evening. How do you portray enlightenment? Very difficult.
Well, it was a very worthwhile evening for me, and you did take us on quite a journey. Speak a little bit about theater in Los Angeles right now. I'm guessing you don't have these big endowments. It just feels like a part of the community, and I'm sure there's a lot of struggles, you know, of course, with the pandemic, but just also running a theater. It takes a lot of money. By the way, you guys have really good parking. I just want to let people know that.
Thank you. Well, the interesting thing, too, is that even among the small theaters, we're sort of a minority, because the trend now is to do a lot of plays about social diversity and political subjects and so on. And those are extremely interesting and should be done. It's never been our forte. Our forte has always been to look at the larger questions of life, not the passing things that are going on in our world in this particular decade, let's say. But the overall meaning of things, the overall questions about existence, that's been more our forte. And in that respect, it's very hard to get funding. Because people are much more interested in subjects like diversity and social equality and so on among the funders. But we struggle along. We have three 99-seat theaters and try to always surprise our audience, not to fall into any particular niche.
Well, you have a very devoted following, and I would recommend people check out Wakings at the Odyssey Theater. It'll be there till June 5th.
Right.
OdysseyTheater.com for more information. Thank you, Ron Saucy, for this time.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started the show with my homage to Shakespeare and, of course, a couple of corny jokes. In preparation for the interview I did with the cast of King Lear, King Lear is at the Wallace through June 5th. Then we heard some Elizabethan music, Ye French Volta, Mistress Mine, Twelfth Night, and Che Passa. Then an interview I did with Ron Saucy. He's the director of a play called Wakings at the Odyssey Theater in West Los Angeles through June 5th. OdysseyTheater.com for more information about that. And we just wrapped things up with Bagatelles by Beethoven, number 3, 4, and 5, performed by Ina Felix. Ukrainian-American pianist Ina Felix will be performing these bagatelles in a program called Reimagine Beethoven and Ravel on Thursday, June 22nd at the Wallace Theater in Beverly Hills. More information about this great show with Ina Felix and King Lear, starring Joe Morton, who you may recognize from ABC's Scandal, at thewallace.org. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with more of the finest of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!